Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I am Justin Asiri. Normally, I interview veterans about their civilian career as a kind of coffee chat to learn about what career options are out there. This is part of an ongoing series I'm calling Skills Series, Skills with a Z maybe. The goal here is just to dive deeper into specific things that come up in interviews and just kind of give you some background or additional ammo in your career. So one of the things I interviewed recently, Jason Hodell, who is the CEO of Skullcandy, and one of the things he said in his final words was learn the lingo. That's one of the things he recommended to veterans to succeed in their transition and in their civilian career. And so I wanted to do this as a terminology episode, and I'll consider this part one. If there are terms that come up that you have heard on an interview or you've heard out on TV or in the wild and you'd like to go through that, send me a note, justin@beyondtheuniform.io or on Twitter or at the website submission contact submission form. Let me know and I will cover that in part two of terminology. And honestly, you know, I've been out for 10 years now, so a lot of the terms that I use or that people might use in these interviews, I might not even be aware of that's not something that, you know, someone on active duty would be familiar with. So this is just a laundry list approach, and, you know, this is just one man's perspective on what these terms mean. But my intention is to give you a little bit of background and help you start building up that lingo. So I'll just go straight through. First one, HR. It's come up in a lot of different interviews. HR is just short for human resources. It's actually, you know, shares some overlap with the military, but human resources is required for hiring in larger organizations. It could be for firing, setting up the recruiting process, finding people, making people happy, lots of different things that can fall under that human resources bucket. Usually I think of it in terms of recruiting, but especially at larger organizations, they'll have all sorts of functions to make sure that employees are well taken care of. A lot of terminology comes up around finance, and I'm going to go through five different terms. Actually, I'll do six different terms, and I'm going to take this from the standpoint of if you were starting a company, how finance would play a role as you grow that company. And so some of the terms you may have heard on the show, the first one is friends and family. So traditionally, when you start, another term would be bootstrapping. That's starting a startup with your own funds without any sort of outside investment. That would be bootstrapping. The next would be that typically people would go to friends and family, people who know them, and so might be willing to take more of a risk because they know that person, they have faith in them, and so they give them money to further the idea. And that's usually at the point where the idea doesn't have legs enough yet to get outside investment, but that would be called a friends and family round. So we have bootstrapped, friends and family. The next tier is angel or angel investing. And you may have heard many of our entrepreneurs on the show talk about this. Angel investors, you know, the way I think of them are people who have a lot of money. Oftentimes, this is entrepreneurs who had a successful exit. They made money. It could just be people who are independently wealthy. But they're basically giving you a check. They're investing in the business. And they probably do this somewhat often, but they're by no means a professional investor. It's not like they're the next group, which we'll call venture capitalists. Angel investors are great often because they are invested in the idea. They're a little bit more willing to get their sleeves rolled up and help. Oftentimes, it's an emotional investment. They might not be doing it purely for finance, but because they really enjoy being involved in these really early stage startups. So bootstrapped, friends and family, angel. The next round is venture capitalists. These are professional investors. When I think of this, this is very often in Silicon Valley and now more and more in New York, LA, Chicago, throughout the US. There's a whole laundry list of common venture capitalists that we could talk about in number two if you want. Kleiner Perkins, Andreessen Horowitz, First Round, tons of different well-known investors. But these are professional organizations. They will do fundraising of their own. They'll go out and raise massive funds. And what venture capitalists do is they have a portfolio of investments. So they will invest in a startup and they'll invest in 19 others. And their strategy is that one of those startups, if just one of them hits out of the park and is worth billions, they can have a positive return on the entire fund. So they're diversifying their risk amongst a variety of startups. The biggest difference in my experience between angels and venture capitalists is because venture capitalists do this for a profession, they've really refined a skill set in assessing the biggest risks associated with a startup and really drilling down, whether it's market size, whether it's the competitive landscape, on different things that might prohibit your startup from succeeding. And as one friend told me, you know, in pitching to venture capitalists, it's all about having their greed outweigh their fear, because every business will have a lot of risk associated with it. So there's always fear, but enticing them with that greed that your startup could be the one to make it to that billion-dollar range and return, you know, a strong return for the fund. So you have bootstrapping, friends and family, angel, venture capitalists. I guess the other component of that, the difference with angel investors, in my experience, you know, a lot of the angel investors, the meetings I would have would be very different. The angel might like one particular aspect of my business and hate another. I meet with the next angel and it's the exact opposite. Instead, with venture capitalists, it seemed to be pretty straightforward. If one venture capitalist thought it wasn't a big enough market size, that would be the trend for other venture capitalists. So it's important to really iterate and figure out how to better explain or better cover that gap. The next round up from this, I would consider... you know, maybe it's a gray area, but investment banking or private equity. I'll just kind of focus on private equity, which is, you know, this is, I view this as the companies may be considered a startup by some, but this is now when you have the next tier of investments. It's, you know, venture capitalists will have Series A, which is the first round investing, Series B, Series C, Series D. At some point, you have private equity coming in here, and this is more of, this is an established company. Now, how can we help them scale, which is another term? How can we help them grow linearly, or even better yet, exponentially? And then the last one would be, you have private equity. The next one would be called public equities, or sometimes also called hedge funds. And public equities is investing in the public market, in the stock market. And so oftentimes an investment bank will come in, like Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or JP Morgan. They'll come into a startup like Facebook and they'll take them public. They'll take them on what's called a roadshow, where they go around with the team, they pitch their business, they say why it's so great, and then they have an initial offering where they go public on the stock markets, and they're raising money from that point from anyone who wants to invest in them. And then once the company is public, you know, it's a great liquidity event, which is another term you probably hear on the show. That's, in my view, that's basically cashing out. You sell your company through an acquisition, that's a liquidity event. You go public, that's a liquidity event. It's kind of de-risking and getting rid of some of that stock or equity in exchange for actual money. But anyways, when you go public, now you have corporate shareholders, you have a much more higher level of scrutiny of your finances, a lot of your information is public, but that's the world of hedge funds and public equities. And each of those are potential career paths for veterans. You know, angel investing is probably going to be a career path if you hit it big and have a lot of money, but venture capital, investment banking, private equity, and public equities or hedge funds, these are all career paths. And in my experience, you know, a lot of my friends from Stanford Business School, they, you know, some of them had done investment banking before business school, Even fewer of them had done private equity before business school, but the career path that I saw, that I was familiar with, was someone would do investment banking, they go to business school, and potentially they make the jump then to private equity or to public equity or hedge funds or venture capital. But I'm more used to seeing people with some sort of finance background make it into the venture capital, investment banking, private equity, or public equity career paths. Next set of terminology, we'll often talk about the C-suite. That's the letter C in suite. This is just kind of the grouping of the highest level of management of a company, specifically chief executive officer. That's the person at the helm of the ship. That's the commanding officer. That's the final stop for a company. And that's, you know, there's CEOs of a one-person company and 50-person companies and 1,000-person companies. COO is the chief operating officer. We've had lots of those on the show, and they talk about, you know, everything from a 10-person startup with a COO to a 1,000-person company with a COO. But that's kind of the head of operations, and I think that that's a career path really well suited to veterans because it's all about executing. It's all about keeping the trains running on time and all the operational aspects. There's the chief financial officer or CFO. I've had John Quarles on the show to talk about being a CFO and just kind of being the person who is overall in charge of finance and budget and making sure they don't run out of money and raising money. All sorts of things go into the CFO. Some terms that I've seen lately are CRO or chief revenue officer, CSO or chief strategy officer, CIO and chief information officer or chief innovation officer, one of the two, CTO, chief technology officer, the head engineer, the person in charge of the technology and the architecture and scaling. So anything that has a C in front of it is a C-suite position. And we'll usually use that as shorthand that you know this is the top level of management. This is kind of the, I don't even know the military analogy anymore, what this is, the brigade or battalion level of management. Sometimes on the show, we'll talk about domain expertise. That's just someone who is built up knowledge in a specific area. You know, oftentimes for me with my startup story box, I'll be researching, let's say, fashion and apparel, or I'll be researching social media marketing or ad agencies or a specific area, and I'll reach out to a business school classmate or someone I know on LinkedIn, and that request is around a domain expertise of saying, hey, you know a lot about this particular domain. Can I pick your brain? So sometimes you'll hear guests on the show talk about domain expertise. The next group is kind of around career, and I've got a lot of papers on the resources section of the beyonduniform.io website that dive deep into where veterans typically end up in terms of industry and in terms of functional roles and geographic areas. Those are kind of the trifecta. So let's start with industries. My view on industries is, you know, when I came out of the Naval Academy, I had a couple career paths. I could go SEALs, Marine Corps, aviation, surface warfare, maybe Med Corps, submarines. And in my view, this is kind of the industries of the military, or specifically of the Navy. And the only difference is when you get out of the military, instead of, you know, for me in the Navy, I had, what, six, quote, industries to choose from, or warfare specialties. Once you get out, according to LinkedIn, there's actually 143 industries that you can choose from. And in my research on Beyond the Uniform, I've grouped these down into, I think, 12 different subsets of those 143. But it's still a big swath of different industries you can choose from. And that's why on the website, I break down episodes by industry so that if you're thinking of technology, high tech, finance, retail, consumer packaged goods, entrepreneurship, general management, consulting, any of these things, these are all industries that correlate with maybe like warfare specialties, is how you could think about it on active duty. The next component there, the next of these three, is functional roles. And the way that I think of this is, you know, on my submarine, we had weapons division, sonar division, auxiliary division, machinery division, electrical division, all these different divisions with the chief and all these things. My view on that, that's the equivalent of a functional role. So within every industry, whether it's finance or retail, whether it's food and beverage, you're going to have different roles. And some of the popular ones that we've had on the show are around sales, marketing, operations, general rent management, human resources, as you now know, as cool kids are, is HR, product management, project management. These are all functional roles. And then that third component is geographic location. And I remember Irv Grosbeck, one of my professors at Stanford Business School. This guy owns the Boston Celtics. He's done pretty well for himself. He talked about, you know, you've got to choose which one of these you're going to focus on. Are you going to focus on a geographic location and say, hey, I want to live in Chicago or Austin or Denver or wherever? Do you want to focus on a particular industry? And you build up expertise of like, hey, I really know fashion and apparel. I really know food and beverage. It makes me think of some of the interviews I've had on the show where the person's built up expertise in Chick-fil-A of being in the food and beverage space. And Cal Newport, which is one of the best interviews I've had, this author of this book, So Good You Can't They Can't Ignore You, talks about building up career capital, just really investing time to build up, here we go again, domain expertise in a certain industry, and that can be very valuable. But you could also build up that domain expertise in a functional role and just really dominate operations or sales or marketing. Just realize that for almost all of us when we get out of the military, we don't have domain expertise. There's certain things you've done that will suit you well for any of these, sales, operations, marketing, but oftentimes you'll have to kind of start at the bottom of the totem pole and build up that functional expertise in the civilian sector, and then you can cash that in for better opportunities. Liquidity event we already talked about. Some other ones, just lifestyle ones. SO is a common one. This is a big business school term, but I hear it often in the business world as well. SO is significant other. It's the modern way of not assuming that the person has a husband or wife, but just kind of, hey, whoever you're in a relationship with, whether that, you know, whoever that is, you can refer them as significant other. And you know, that's something that I'll see veterans or people who have recently transitioned maybe slip up on. It's not an egregious error, but it kind of is like, could be a faux pas if you're talking to a man and you say, hey, like, is your wife here? It's kind of assuming things that might not be accurate. They might have a husband, they might have a boyfriend, they might have a girlfriend. So significant other is kind of the neutral term for that. Another business school term was FOMO. I hear this in the business world as well. FOMO is fear of missing out, and that's just the sense that there's so many things going on. No matter what you do, you feel like you're missing out on something, or if you stay in one night, you feel like there's something else going on. Fear of missing out can be a big component when you have so many different things that you could be doing, which I believe the case will be for most all of you once you get out of the military. You just have a lot more freedom and autonomy and choice in what you do. Last would be, a lot of times on the show we'll talk about bored. That's B-O-A-R-D, not bored as in I've got nothing else to do. A board usually refers to a board of directors. So anytime you have professional investors, which you now know is venture capitalists or above, anytime you have professional investors, you're most likely going to have a board of directors. Actually, if you start a company solo, you're going to be on the board of directors. You're the only board member. But then as you get, it's like for me, when we got our first investor, I had now a board member from our first investor. And then because there's two of us, you never want to be in a position where you have an irreconcilable difference. They'll often appoint a third board member, which is called the independent board member. And this is someone that both board members agree on, the entrepreneur and the investor, as someone who's neutral. And you know, the board has what's called a fiduciary responsibility. That is a responsibility to do what's best for the company. And so that independent board member can sometimes be placed in an awkward position of saying, hey, I know I'm friends with the founder, or hey, maybe I'm friends with this investor, and I believe what's best for the company is different than what this person is advocating for. Or what's best for the company might not be best for the founder, who might be one of the board members. And you'll sometimes see where the founder, who's the chief executive officer, part of the C-suite, will be ousted. You know, they'll say, look, we just don't think you've got the skill to take this company to the next level. And that can be a tumultuous event. So you'll most often see boards as odd numbers to prevent any sort of, you know, to have the tiebreaker. But any company, any public company has a board of directors. And as people get senior in their career, that's can be a nice side professional outlet for them to serve on the board, to be on the board of a nonprofit, to be on the board of a startup. It's kind of a way of lending domain expertise to a team and contributing. And the board of directors usually gets some sort of equity grant. They have some sort of ownership in the company, so that if the company does well, they're rewarded. It's that would be called, you know, directly tying their incentives or having their interests directly aligned with the company. The other term that, you know, the other type of board is board of advisors, and that's just more of a arrangement of different people with domain expertise that can could contribute to a company's growth. So, you know, over the last 8 years with Storybox, I've had a dozen different board of advisor members. And for those of you interested in looking at that, there's a something called the FAST form. I forget what it even stands for, but if you type in like FAST form advisors on Google, you'll find this. What's interesting about this is one approach, one organization's attempt to formalize a board of advisor structure in saying, hey, based on where the company is at, whether they're super early stage or later stage, and based on what the advisor brings to the table. Some advisors will just make introductions for sales. Some advisors will work one day a week on your company. Some advisors you'll meet with every quarter and they'll give you an hour of their time. So what the FAST form has done is it tries to break down based on where your company's at and based on what the advisor's gonna be doing, it outlines equity or percentage ownership of the company that advisor would get. And I just put that out there because of those of you who are interested in either joining a startup or starting your own company, it's one of the few objective criteria I've found for equity or ownership in a company. And so, you know, sometimes when you join a company, they'll give you shares which represent a percentage of the company. And this is maybe getting a little bit too in the weeds, but shares are pretty much meaningless. A lot of times people will get a job offer and it says, hey, I've got 10,000 shares. And like, that's awesome. That's a lot. And maybe it is, you know, 10,000 shares if the company has 100,000 shares is pretty good. 10,000 shares if the company has 10 million shares, that's a different scenario. So they'll talk in terms of stock, but what's really helpful to know is the amount of equity, and that's more of a percentage ownership. And some companies won't disclose that. They'll consider that private. But once you start to deal in equity or percentage ownership of the company, it's a little bit easier to assess because then you're saying, hey, this is worth, you know, maybe you're very early in a startup as an advisor or as an employee, and maybe you get 25% ownership, or, you know, maybe you're an investor and you get 25% ownership. That's incredible. You know, you could make a lot of money off of that if the company does well. Versus as the company progresses, an advisor might get 0.1%. You know, 0.5%. And that's the last term I'll cover, which is called basis points. That's just a cool way of saying 0.5. Instead of 0.5, it would be 50 basis points. Or if you want to be even cooler, 50 bips. You know, and so that's just a fast way of saying, you know, basis points is just percentage. So take the percentage and multiply it by 100, so 0.75 basis points becomes 75 basis points. And so, you know, a later stage employee will get 0.5%, 0.25%, 0.1%, or even less. And that's all contingent on where the company is at in terms of its growth, as well as how much value you bring into the table as an employee or even an advisor. And what's crazy is, you know, because advisors often have more domain expertise, you'll sometimes see advisors getting a much larger share of the company than, you know, a junior salesperson or a junior customer support system person, because that advisor with their domain expertise is bringing more to the table. So that's all the terms I'd written down that seemed like they might be unfamiliar for veterans. If this is helpful, let me know, shoot me a note. If there's other terms you'd like me to dive into and hack at explaining, happy to do so as well. As always, more information at beyonduniform.io. If you haven't left us a positive iTunes review, would greatly appreciate that. It helps us get the word out. And if you're not on our newsletter, definitely sign up. You can do that at the website at the top of the page or at beyonduniform.io/newsletter. I'll be back in just a few days with more interviews with our veterans, and have a great week. This episode of Beyond the Uniform is sponsored by Storybox. People trust each other more than they trust advertising. Storybox provides companies with the tools they need to take the best things their customers are saying and use these testimonials to drive more sales and referrals. You can find out if Storybox is right for you at storyboxlite.com. If you employ a veteran, we'll also give you a 10% discount. That's storyboxlite, L-I-T-E.com.